Hello and welcome to Money Trail with me, Amir Arfat. Today, the international banking cartel, from the Rothschilds to the House of Morgan to the Federal Reserve. Who controls the world's money?
The four horsemen of banking, Bank of America, JP Morgan Chase, Citigroup, and Wells Fargo, own the four horsemen of oil, ExxonMobil, Royal Dutch Shell, BP, and Chevron Texaco. In tandem with Deutsche Bank, BNP, Barclays, and other European old money behemoths. But their monopoly over the global economy does not end at the edge of the oil patch. According to company 10K filings to the SEC, the four horsemen of banking are among the top 10 stockholders of virtually every Fortune 500 corporation.
The fact is 52% of the New York Fed is owned by these eight families. It's the Rockefellers, Rothschilds, Goldman Sachs, Lehman's, Lazard's, Warburg's, Kuhn-Loebs, and Israel Moses Seif's. And the latter family, that goes back to the Genoese bankers, you know, when they first moved into Europe. And these are just really old families. And you know the saying, money begets more money. You know, you got to have money to make money. Well, guess what? These people had money in the 16th century, whatever. And so, you know, many people estimate that the Rothschilds, the richest of these families, are worth over $100 trillion.
The international banking cartel is a consortium of about 15 to 20 to 25 international banks of large magnitude with large amounts of political influence. These are the too big to fail banks around the world. They're too big to fail. They're too big to jail. And they are essentially the ones who control the private central banks of the world, because in most countries, United States, Britain, Germany, Japan, and so on down the line, the central bank is a privately controlled institution, even if it's not always, formally speaking, privately owned.
The control that these banking families exert over the global economy cannot be overstated and is quite intentionally shrouded in secrecy. Their corporate media arm is quick to discredit any information exposing this private central banking cartel as conspiracy theory. Yet the facts remain.
And what my book is about is how they've established this total monopoly over the three most valuable commodities in the world, guns, drugs, and oil. And then, worse yet, they've taken over the central banks of every country, not just the Federal Reserve, but, you know, the Bank of England, the Bundesbank, the Bank of France, Bank of Australia, I mean, you name it. And it's just stranger than fiction that this can happen. But, you know, these banking cartels with our fiat currency system where they can, you know, print more money, lend out more money than they actually have in reserve, and the government backs it.
We have the Royal Bank of Scotland. We have HSBC. That's the old Hong Kong Shanghai Banking Corporation. Lloyds Bank, TSB. That has absorbed HBOS, Building Society. Is followed then by Bank of America, Citigroup, JP Morgan Chase, UBS, Credit Suisse, Deutsche Bank and Westdeutsche Landesbank of Germany, Societe Generale of France, the Bank of Tokyo Mitsubishi UJF, Norinchukin of Japan, Royal Bank of Canada, and Rabobank of the Netherlands. Now that group, 15, 16 banks, that is essentially the heart of the cartel.
One important repository for the wealth of the global oligarchy that owns these bank holding companies is U.S. Trust Corporation, founded in 1853 and now owned by Bank of America. A recent U.S. Trust corporate director and honorary trustee was Walter Rothschild. Other directors included Daniel Davison of J.P. Morgan Chase, Richard Tucker of ExxonMobil, Daniel Roberts of Citigroup, and Marshall Schwartz of Morgan Stanley.
Basically, it's like these families are running this printing press, and they get countries in debt, they get individuals in debt, they get companies in debt, and when those people go into debt and can't pay their loans back, then these bankers come in and seize the real asset, which is the house, the car, the Mexican National Cement Company, which is what they did in the Mexican debt crisis in 1997. The way they got out of that was they handed over all their state assets to ASARCO and BNN, took over the whole railroad in Mexico. And, you know, it's a scam.
And now the world's biggest and perhaps oldest modern banking family. Ladies and gentlemen, the Rothschilds.
In In 1694, William III teamed up with the UK aristocracy to launch the Private Bank of England. The Rothschilds and their inbred eight families' partners gradually came to control the Bank of England. Mayor Angela Rothschild once said, quote, "I care not who controls a nation's political affairs so long as I control her currency."
Amschel Meyer Bauer inherited the business. He decided to change his name to Rothschild. Amschel soon learned that loaning money to governments and kings was more profitable than loaning to private individuals. Not only were the loans bigger, but they were secured by the nation's taxes. Mayor Rothschild had five sons. He trained them all in the skills of money creation, then sent them out to the major capitals of Europe to open branch offices of the family banking business. His first son, Amschel Meyer, stayed in Frankfurt to mine the hometown bank. His second son, Solomon, was sent to Vienna. His third son, Nathan, was clearly the most clever. He was sent to London at age 21 in 1798, 100 years after the founding of the Bank of England. His fourth son, Carl, went to Naples, and his fifth son, Jacob, went to Paris. Rothschild soon grew unbelievably wealthy. By the mid-1800s, they dominated all European banking and were certainly the wealthiest family in the world.
The Rothschild family was a German banking family. Their original name was Bauer. They changed their name to Rothschild. The sons of Mayer, Amschel, Bauer Rothschild, were spread out across Europe. They funded all sides of all conflicts. I guess the most famous instance of that is when they funded the Duke of Wellington and the Bonaparte's army.
And they financed the Crimean War, and they financed Napoleon and all that stuff. Wellington, both sides of that conflict. And that was the pattern. They started getting the royal families of Europe into debt to them, so they'd owe them money.
This is the Waterloo battlefield, about 200 miles northeast of Paris, in what today is Belgium. Here, Napoleon suffered his final defeat, but not before thousands of French and Englishmen gave their lives on a steamy summer day in July of 1815. The outcome was certainly in doubt. In fact, had Napoleon attacked a few hours earlier, he would probably have won the battle. But no matter who won or lost, back in London, Nathan Rothschild planned to use the opportunity to try to seize control over the British stock and bond market, and possibly even the Bank of England. The day after the Battle of Waterloo, in a matter of hours, Nathan Rothschild came to dominate not only the bond market, but the Bank of England as well. Whether or not the Rothschild family seized control of the Bank of England, the first privately owned central bank in a major European nation and the wealthiest, one thing is certain. By the mid-1800s, the Rothschilds were the richest family in the world, bar none.
Over two centuries, disguising what they're doing, disguising what the ownership of their corporations is, there is no reliable information on the magnitude of their wealth in this day and age.
Author Frederick Martin estimates that by 1850, the Rothschilds were worth over $10 billion. Some researchers believe that their fortune today exceeds $100 trillion.
That's how the Rothschilds started, was by funding these wars in Europe, and they just gained power. The Rockefellers in America were financed by the Rothschilds, along with the Kuhn-Loeb family.
They financed Cecil Rhodes, making it possible for him to establish a monopoly over the diamond and gold fields of South Africa. In America, they financed the Harrimans and railroads, the Vanderbilts and railroads and the press, and Carnegie in the steel industry, among many others.
In fact, during World War I, J.P. Morgan was thought to be the richest man in America. But after his death, it was discovered that he was actually only a lieutenant of the Rothschilds.
By 1850, James Rothschild, the heir of the French branch of the family, was said to be worth 600 million French francs, 150 million more than all the other bankers in France put together.
He built this mansion called Ferrier, just east of Paris.
Wilhelm I, on seeing it, exclaimed, "Kings couldn't afford this. It could only belong to a Rothschild."
At the heart of the whole Rothschild money accumulation was that relationship they had with these royals. And then, then they started acquiring control of all these central banks. And once again, once you have, $1 billion, easy to make $10 billion. Once you have $10 billion, $100 billion's nothing. Once you have that, $100 trillion's nothing.
Today, the Rothschilds control a far-flung financial empire, which includes majority stakes in most world central banks. They are founding members of the exclusive $10 trillion Club of the Isles, which controls corporate giants Royal Dutch Shell, Imperial Chemical Industries, Lloyd's of London, Unilever, Barclays, Lorno, Rio Tinto Zinc, BHP Billiton. The Club of Isles is led by the Rothschilds and includes Queen Elizabeth II and other wealthy European aristocrats and black nobility. It dominates the world's supply of petroleum, gold, diamonds, and many other vital raw materials.
You can't tell the difference between, the Rothschilds and the royals. It's all the same stuff. And they have joint investments. The biggest investment, I believe, is the Quantum NV Fund, which is based in Curacao, which interestingly is also home to the biggest oil refineries in the Western Hemisphere. It's just north of Venezuela, so they take all that Venezuelan crude, they take Nigerian crude there, they have these huge refineries, Royal Dutch Shell and ExxonMobil on them. And they also have this Quantum NV Fund. A lot of offshore stuff happens there.
How about the American version of the Rothschilds? Who started banking in the U.S.?
The House of Morgan presided over American finance from the corner of Wall Street, acting as quasi-U.S. central bank since 1838, when George Peaboy founded it in London. The Morgan financial octopus wrapped its tentacles quickly around the globe. Morgan Grenfell operated in London. Morgan & Sue ruled Paris. The Rothschilds' Lambert cousins set up Drexel & Company in Philadelphia. The House of Morgan financed the launch of AT&T, General Motors, General Electric, and DuPont. Like the London-based Rothschild and Barings banks, Morgan became part of a power structure in many countries.
Morgan was the official U.S. representative of the City of London and British banking. He was London's man in New York City. This gave him dominant power.
A recession in 1893 enhanced Morgan's power. That year, Morgan saved the U.S. government from a bank panic, forming a syndicate to prop up government reserves with a shipment of $62 million worth of Rothschild gold.
The origin of the situation we're in now, right? Where do we get this world banking cartel, and how do they control the finances and the central banks of these countries? It actually takes us back to 1895, and this was an attack on the United States, organized by London and by Morgan. And the goal was to force the U.S. Off the gold standard by buying up all the gold that was in the backing of the U.S. dollar. And at the height of the crisis, there's a meeting between Grover Cleveland and the current Morgan of those days. Grover Cleveland was the president of the United States. And essentially, Morgan said, "London and I demand to control the U.S. public debt, and if you do that, we'll stop attacking the dollar. But if you don't, we'll wreck the dollar, we'll cause a depression, and that will be the end of you." And at that point, Grover Cleveland surrendered to London and to Morgan.
Morgan was a driving force behind Western expansion in the U.S., financing and controlling westbound railroads through voting trusts. The House of Morgan was cozy with the British House of Windsor and the Italian House of Savoy, the Kuhn Loebs, Warburgs, Lehmans, Lazards, Israel Moses Seifs, and Goldman Sachs also had close ties to European royalty. By 1895, Morgan controlled the flow of gold in and out of the U.S. The House of Morgan financed half the U.S. World War I effort, while receiving commissions for lining up contractors like GE, DuPont, U.S. Steel, Kennecott, and Asarco. Morgan also financed the British Boer War in South Africa and the Franco-Prussian War. The 1919 Paris Peace Conference was presided over by Morgan, which led both German and Allied to reconstruction efforts.
Money makes strange bedfellows. How the Morgans and Rockefellers came together.
In 1879, Cornelius Vanderbilt's Morgan financed New York's Central Railroad, gave preferential shipping rates to John D. Rockefeller's budding Standard Oil monopoly, cementing the Rockefeller-Morgan relationship. Morgan and Edward Harriman's banker, Kung Loeb, held a monopoly over the railroads, while banking dynasties Lehman, Goldman Sachs, and Lazard joined the Rockefellers in controlling the U.S. industrial base.
The Morgans financed all the railroads, and Rockefeller at that time was, you know, just another guy in the oil patch. And what he did is he cut deals with the railroads based on volume, that they would transport his crude at a better rate than other people got. And so not only that, but he started selling oil. He started selling oil below cost to refiners. And what that did is it drove a lot of wildcatters out of business in Texas, Louisiana, because they, you know, that you can't sell oil for less than the price it costs to produce, right? Unless you're John Rockefeller. And so he ran them out of business, and then he bought all the refineries. But that's the most notable instance where, you know, J.P. Morgan, you know, early on with the railroads helped the Rockefeller family and vice versa. Well, what you have now is J.P. Morgan Chase. So, see, the Chase Bank has always been the Rockefeller Bank, the big one, and along with Citigroup. But the Citigroup, James Stillman and some other families that have big chunks of that, Harkness family. But Chase has always been the Rockefeller Bank.
In the insurance business, the Rockefellers control Metropolitan Life, Equitable Life, Prudential, and New York Life. Rockefeller banks control 25% of all assets of the 50 largest U.S. commercial banks and 30% of all assets of the 50 largest insurance companies. Companies under Rockefeller control include ExxonMobil, Chevron Texaco, BP, Marathon Oil, Freeport McMoRan, Quaker Oats, Asarco, United Delta, Northwest, ITT, International Harvester, Xerox, Boeing, Westinghouse, Hewlett-Packard, Honeywell, International Paper, Pfizer, Motorola, Union Carbide, and General Foods.
Speaking of the international banking cartel, how about the U.S. Federal Reserve? Where does the Fed stand?
The Federal Reserve is a center of it. It's really one of the governing institutions. By the way, let me say, I write about this in my book, Surviving the Cataclysm, Your Guide Through the Greatest Financial Crisis in Human History. And here on the cover, we have the Fed breaking up.
Everyone who can read the writing on the wall can see the Federal Reserve Bank controls the United States government. They control every aspect of the economy. And they are controlled by a international bank, according to the rules that everybody knows, Basel III. That's the rules by which all the private central banks operate. And it's set in a foreign country, which means the Federal Reserve Bank is a treasonous institution that destroys or has destroyed American sovereignty, as has the European Central Bank and the banks around the world, as has, you know, every nation where these Rothschild central banks operate out of.
How about the central bank of all central banks? The Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland.
The Bank for International Settlements is the most powerful bank in the world, a global central bank for the eight families who control the private central banks of almost all Western and developing nations. The Bank for International Settlements is owned by the Federal Reserve, Bank of England, Bank of Italy, Bank of Canada, Swiss National Bank, Nederlandse Bank, Bundesbank, and Bank of France.
Naturally, it's a sinister institution, right? Secretive, wealthy, with no accountability, no transparency, no TV cameras, no nothing, all secret. This is the kind of thing that would have to end.
It's hard to find out about it, for sure. This BIS crowd, Bank of International Settlements, it's in Basel, Switzerland. It's a central bank for central bankers. It keeps its head low. It's owned by the same families, and basically only comes out in times of extreme crisis.
The Bank for International Settlements has been operating in Basel since, I believe, 1931, 1932. And it grows out of a distant world, but which is not so dissimilar from our own world. If you go back to the period after World War I, the most dangerous kind of financial debt were the reparations that Germany was required to pay billions and billions of dollars as a result of losing World War One and being blamed for World War One, which was not historically true. But it was impossible to have the reparations paid. Germany simply could not pay. Lord Keynes saw this at the time. Many others saw it at the time. So there were constant attempts to reorganize the reparations and keep them going. One was the Dawes Plan of 1923-24, and then there was the Young Plan of 1931-32, which also created the Bank for International Settlement.
Historian Carol Quigley wrote in his epic book Tragedy and Hope, the Bank for International Settlements was part of a plan to, quote, create a world system of financial control in private hands able to dominate the political system of each country and the economy of the world as a whole, to be controlled in a feudalistic fashion by the central banks of the world acting in concert by secret agreements.
The international banking cartel that controls the central banks of all but three nations operates under the rules set by something, an international body called the Bank for International Settlements in Basel, Switzerland. And the central banks of the world, from the United States to Russia to China, they all operate under Basel III, is what's being transitioned into now. And Basel III is the rules by which all of these banks operate. There's, you know, complex organizations, international organizations, and secret societies that carry out the will of these banks. And, you know, the leadership of those groups are the major stockholders of the Bank for International Settlements.
The Bank for International Settlements holds at least 10% of monetary reserves for at least 80 of the world's central banks, the IMF, and other multilateral institutions. It serves as financial agent for international agreements, collects information on the global economy, and serves as lender of last resort to prevent global financial collapse. It served as conduit for eight families' funding of Adolf Hitler, led by Warburg's Henry Schroeder, and Mendelssohn Bank of Amsterdam. Many researchers assert the Bank for International Settlements is a donator of global drug money laundering.
It's a banking cartel that prints money out of thin air and charges people interest and leverages its war machine, which exhibits itself in the Russian military, the United States military, the Chinese military, and they play different nationalities of people off of one another in order to enslave the planet and consolidate their power.
Politicians often declare wars, but who are the true warmongers? Who are the people that fund the wars? Who are the true war profiteers?
The controlling of the money supply and the economy is only a portion of the power the international bankers wield against us. The next tool for profit and control is war. Since the inception of the Federal Reserve in 1913, it seems as if we have been in a perpetual war at one place or another. There's a reason for this. It's important to understand that the most lucrative thing that can happen for the international bankers is war, for it forces the country to borrow even more money from the Federal Reserve Bank at interest. Not only that, but they have heavy investments in the weapons manufacturers.
Guns, drugs, oil. If you look at the numbers, it's the three most valuable commodities in the world. So if you're a banker, you're going to want war. You can sell oil to both sides. You can sell guns to both sides. And you can run drugs through the war zone and nobody will know where it's going and launder that money easily. Big old stacks of $100 bills. Also gold and diamonds. All these things go through war zones as currency. And of course, they own the defense contractors. These same families own Lockheed Martin. They own BAE, British Aerospace. They own all the biggest defense contractors.
Well, thank you for watching. Always follow the money trail with me, Amir Arfa.